This is Pittsburgh Explainer, a podcast from 90.5 WESA. Every Friday, we help you understand some of the most important news stories from southwestern Pennsylvania. It's Friday, May 8th. Thanks for joining us. I'm your host, Liz Reed. 24 northwestern and north central Pennsylvania counties move into the yellow phase of Governor Tom Wolf's reopening plan today. That means daycares are allowed to open back up, as are churches and most retail businesses.
They must continue to abide by the underlying message of yellow. Proceed with caution. The yellow phase recognizes that outbreaks of COVID-19 are still possible, and all businesses will still need to operate under the orders and guidance that establish social distancing and cleaning protocols.
This week, the Wolf administration released a document outlining those protocols, but some businesses are still unclear on what they need to do.
I spent hours researching. I thought the guidance was really vague in the beginning.
Jim McGluskey is the director of operations at McGluskey Showcase Kitchens and Baths in New Wilmington, Lawrence County. He says it took him about a week to wrap his head around what his business needs to do to reopen to customers, and that he was grateful for the help of organizations like the Master Builders Association and Better Business Bureau.
There was a lot of information that wasn't categorized to be easily identified, and so you had to spend a lot of time reading and researching to see what was applicable to your business. So it was challenging.
In addition to its retail showroom, the company does residential construction, installing the products it sells. Sometimes it was hard to tell what guidelines were geared toward businesses providing in-home services versus large commercial construction companies. Frances Lestoria owns a Grand Day Bridal Boutique in Newcastle, also in Lawrence County. She plans to open back up to customers on Saturday, but she says some of the guidelines, like putting plastic barriers at registers, don't make a lot of sense for her business.
They talk about hanging a plexiglass. Well, we're not like a Giant Eagle or a Sheetz where you hang a plexiglass. I mean, I'm interacting with the customers before we get to that point where maybe I write up a dress and, you know, they do a deposit or something like that.
Lestoria disagrees with the way the Wolf administration has handled the shutdown. She's worried about how she'll recover financially and says she feels like her business could have operated more safely than some other stores that have been permitted to remain open.
You go to Walmart and people are packed there. My store could have been opened all this time by private appointment, wearing masks, following all those guidelines, and there would have been me and one to two other people in the entire store.
Other businesses that were actually allowed to stay open decided not to. Cheryl Ligo owns Shearer's Candy and Cake Supplies in Newcastle, which is considered a specialty food retail store.
I felt that it was irresponsible for me to stay open when I'm selling candy. I wasn't selling groceries, so it was important to me to keep this virus under control as best we could.
Ligo decided to open back up this week and is urging her customers to place their orders ahead of time for curbside pickup. Still, other businesses, such as Kinder Care Daycare Centers, have no immediate plans to reopen. Melissa Everly is the region director overseeing dozens of facilities in western Pennsylvania and Ohio. She says they'll open their two Erie locations once enough families are ready to come back.
We're still working to understand local family need. It's actually been minimal, so we're still looking into next week as well as following weeks, and we'll open up just as soon as we have families that need us.
With the exception of KinderCare, a national chain with more than $1 billion of annual revenue, these businesses told me they have major concerns about sourcing the disinfecting wipes and hand sanitizer and masks that will allow them to operate. But bridal boutique owner Frances Lestoria says after almost 2 months with no income, she's got to open up.
The only way to make money is to sell product. And in order to do that, the doors need to be open.
The Wolf administration has cautioned that just because an area is moved into the yellow phase, that doesn't necessarily mean green will follow. If there's an outbreak of COVID-19, restrictions could be put back in place. But many small business owners are hopeful that this week marks the beginning of the end of social distancing in Pennsylvania.
Good morning.
Good morning, Sarah. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm hanging in there. So is your cat totally sick of you being around
the
house all the time yet?
I'm happy to say she's totally obsessed with me. She's coming into the room right now. In fact, I hope she doesn't make too much noise. My name is Sarah Bowden, and I'm the health and science reporter at WESA.
So we didn't really end up seeing a substantial surge of COVID-19 patients in southwestern Pennsylvania.
Why is that?
Well, everyone I've talked to says this is the result of social distancing efforts, which were implemented relatively early. And on the public's part, there are data to suggest that compliance has been relatively high. There's cell phone data showing that people are moving less. I talked to one researcher at Pitt who scraped data from Google showing that people are even going to grocery stores less, even though it's one of the few places in public that are still open. And then I think also just the fact that, you know, we're seeing the illness level being pretty low. I think that's evidence in of itself that people are moving around less.
So I've seen some people putting forth a narrative that basically says the lack of surge, the low number of cases is proof that the restrictive stay-at-home orders and the business shutdowns and stuff actually went too far and weren't necessary. Does that make any sense to you? Does that hold any weight?
What public health researchers would say is that when public health initiatives work well, nothing happens. And so the fact that we haven't seen this horrific surge of illness means that our initiatives worked well.
I see. It's kind of like I studied audio production, right? And so one of the things you learn is like when sound design in a movie is good, you don't even notice it. If a movie soundtrack doesn't work, you're going to notice it. But if it all works, you don't even realize that music is playing in the background.
I think that's a really good analogy. Funding for public health is relatively low, has been for a while. People are saying that the fact that funding is so low is one of the reasons we're in this pretty awful situation. Mm-hmm. And public health in many ways has been a victim of its own success, because up until this pandemic, our major concerns were cancers and other diseases, and infectious diseases were just not an issue in the United States because we had vaccines and good sanitation. So this issue, this pandemic that we're confronted with right now, is just so unique for our time. And we haven't needed public health to function in this capacity for a really long time. And the fact that stay-at-home orders, social distancing mandates have worked so well, and then people are going, well, you know, did we really need to do this? I think that's just kind of a repeat of this pattern that when public health initiatives work well, you don't really notice.
So I know hospitals slowed down or even stopped elective surgeries depending on the health system, and visitation has been very limited. We've heard horror stories from hospitals in New York, but we haven't seen those kinds of case numbers here in the Pittsburgh area. So what has it been like inside local hospitals? What have your sources been telling you?
Yeah, more than one person I've spoken to has described a hospital as a ghost town. That seems to be the word that everyone's going to. Both rural and urban facilities have been pretty empty. That's starting to change as more medical systems return to routine care. In addition to, you know, this pause on elective surgeries, the increased use of telehealth, and the fact that COVID levels have been relatively low in Western Pennsylvania, it's also possible that many people have not gone to get urgent care or emergency care when they otherwise would out of fear of COVID exposure.
So starting this week, restrictions in 24 Pennsylvania counties are starting to lift. They've moved into Governor Tom Wolf's yellow phase. Businesses are starting to open back up. Could we still see a surge later this spring into the summer as these social distancing restrictions start to lift? And how will we know if social distancing restrictions need to be put back in place?
I mean, I'm expecting as social distancing restrictions lift, we will see an uptick in cases. The question is how many? And I think that government officials will know or decide to put more restrictive mandates back in place when we see hospitalizations tick up, or when we see the infection rate tick up, which means that eventually hospitalizations and deaths will increase. We know that most people who get COVID-19 will recover at home. Some people may not even know they're infected with the coronavirus. The big concern is the hospitalizations and deaths, and whether or not medical system has enough capacity to care for all its COVID patients.
I am personally hopeful, too, that while numbers of COVID-19 cases are expected to rise in areas where social distancing restrictions are lifted, that people's behavior will be different. I think, for one, people are wearing masks now, which will hopefully cut down on transmission. they may be less likely to go out for certain things that maybe aren't super essential for their lives. People have gotten comfortable with like ordering groceries online, things like that. People have gotten comfortable with cooking more at home or just staying at home more. And then also, we have more ventilators in the state than we did when we were preparing for the first surge. Given that we've learned some lessons in the last couple of months, I'm hopeful that we'll be able to be, I guess, better prepared if a surge does come later on this year.
Yeah, I mean, I've had those thoughts too. We don't know.
There's so much we don't know, but I appreciate you sharing what you do know, Sarah. Enlightening conversations as always.
Nice talking to you, Liz.
Thanks. I'll talk to you later. It's time for a quick break. We'll be right back.
We've Got the Beat is the new 80s show from our sister station, 91.3 WYEP. Thursdays from 10 p.m. to midnight, host Bob Studebaker plays favorites from the decade that brought us post-punk, new wave, and synth-pop. Listen on air at WYEP.org or tell your smart speaker to play WYEP.
Hello.
Hi, Anlie, it's Liz.
Hey, Liz, how are you?
I'm doing okay. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. Don't have much new to report. Pretty much the same from day to day, just given the shutdown.
Yeah, I feel like we've reached the point where every day kind of feels the same. It's a little like Groundhog Day-y.
Yeah. I feel like during the work week, I do pretty much the same routine, which probably helps overall to get through this, but it is starting to get a little old. I'm Anlie Herring. I mostly cover the courts and county government.
But this week, you actually looked at manufacturers in Pennsylvania, right?
Yeah, I did. It was kind of a dip into some economics and business reporting for me, a little out of my ordinary.
So are manufacturers considered life-sustaining businesses in Pennsylvania? Have they been allowed to keep operating?
Well, it depends on which sector they manufacture in. So there's a lot of sectors that are considered life-sustaining. That would include things ranging from steel to semiconductors and wood products, and you'll see it's a pretty long list, but there's also a fair amount of industries that are considered non-life sustaining. So if businesses that work in those areas haven't gotten a waiver from the state, they have had to shut down, and that includes things like textiles, home appliances. One that I mentioned in my story is refractory manufacturing. That's a term I had never heard before. It's the insulation that lines steel furnaces because they get very hot. So this ceramic insulation keeps the heat from being released from the furnace.
Okay, and that was considered non-life sustaining even though steel manufacturing is?
Yeah, that's right. And it's a pretty essential element for steel furnaces, which are used to make steel. So the company that I talked with, Onyx, it's located in Erie, Pennsylvania. They applied for a waiver, but they actually had been operating all along, even though they had to wait 5 days for that waiver, because the U.S. Department of Defense told them that for the Defense Department's purposes, they are essential. So that's just one example of the complications and challenges that have arisen with the shutdown order.
So for manufacturers that have been able to stay open, like how are they approaching social distancing, sanitizing, stuff like that in the workplace?
Yeah, that was a universal challenge that I heard talking with, I think what ended up being 8 or 9 companies in different parts of the state. And they said that that really was the first thing they had to tackle with the pandemic. And so some of them are staggering shifts, so they'll have fewer workers in their facilities at a time. Pretty much all of them have any office staff working from home. And they also have taped lines on the floor so that workers keep a safe distance when they punch in every day. And they also have had to order a lot more hand sanitizer and soap. And that was also a challenge for them because they said back in mid-March when they really had to get all these supplies, it was hard to find where they could buy them. Everything was in short supply and it was taking a long time to get the products. So yeah, that was just one element of a whole host of obstacles they faced.
I would also imagine there's a lot of complexity to navigate in the supply chains for various manufacturers. You know, what one state might consider essential or life-sustaining might be different than another state. Or what if you have to buy components overseas and that factory is shut down because of the rules in that country? I mean, have you talked to any companies who were like, yeah, we would love to keep operating, but we can't get the parts that we need to build our widgets?
I talked to two companies, actually, that make medical devices, and they both experienced enormous surges in demand for their products. And they said that they did struggle to find all the parts they would need to meet that demand. So it took them a few weeks to work through that, but it seems like they have worked through it. But another issue when it comes to supply chains is just that everything's slower. So even if you can locate products, just with the restrictions on movement and the challenges that the pandemic imposes across the board, you're probably going to have to wait longer before those products arrive.
Well, Anli, thanks so much for stepping outside your normal beat to take a look at manufacturing. I mean, I think this is sort of a sector of the economy that's really behind a curtain for a lot of us.
Yeah, of course. It was really fascinating. And thanks for talking with me.
Okay, I'll talk to you later, Anli.
All right, bye.
It's time for another break. Stay with us.
I'm Dave Isay of StoryCorps. Through StoryCorps interviews, people have found wisdom and comfort in the words of their loved ones. At this moment, we need those connections more than ever. That's why, together with public radio stations, we're launching StoryCorps Connect, an online tool to record interviews with loved ones remotely and become part of American history at the Library of Congress. Learn how at StoryCorpsConnect.org.
Hello.
Hey, Miles, it's Liz.
Hey, nice to meet you.
How are you doing?
Pretty good. It's really nice out here in Philly after a couple days of gray and cold. Birds are chirping. It's another day in quarantine, but at least it's nice out. That's basically where I'm at. I'm Miles Bryan, and I report on business and education for WHYY.
So normally on this show, we talk about pretty serious topics, unemployment, incarceration. I'm just spitballing here, global pandemics.
Yes.
But I'm calling you to talk about ping pong. How did this story come about?
It had a more serious origin as the business-oriented business reporter, someone reporting on companies and the decision makers behind them. In the Philly area, I had covered the casinos and gambling in Pennsylvania, and it's a very big industry here, and I thought I should just check in with casinos around the state, actually, and like see what they were doing right now because they're all closed and, you know, if they had been able to move stuff online and how that was going. So I just did a round of calls last week to see what was happening, and I didn't hear anything super interesting at first. You know, when you talk to big companies like the folks behind the casinos in the state, you know, they're very careful and polished about how they present their own deliberations. So they weren't sort of giving me the juicy inside stuff I wanted. But then I kept hearing something that caught my ear, which is like, yeah, sports betting is still on in the absence of major league sports. And what people are betting on by like a large majority is table tennis, Russian table tennis. And so I think that like I heard that at first and I put it in my notes and then I was like, I don't know if I have a story. And then I went back and I was like, oh, I totally have a story because this is bizarre. Sports bettors are turning to ping pong to get through the pandemic.
Why are sports bettors playing these sports right now? I guess what is driving them to continue to sort of scrape the bottom of the barrel in terms of sports betting?
People who enjoy placing bets on sports are super bored and want something to care about and want something to be involved in. Like I talked to this guy for the story, Matthew Nelson. He's a 29-year-old engineer for the city of Philadelphia. You know, he's like maybe your typical sports betting dude. He loves college basketball. He loves baseball. He got into it, you know, when it became legal in Pennsylvania last year just to make the games more exciting and to be in his like group chat with his buddies. He's not doing it to make money or it's not draining him of his finances, but it's just like this fun thing. And then when all the sports shut down, he's like, okay, this is totally over, just like everything else. But a couple of weeks after that shutdown in mid-March, what he told me, he was just like, I'm just so bored. I logged back into my sports betting website and I saw that there was this Russian table tennis match and they were broadcasting it live and I could watch it and bet on it. And I think if you're just into that sort of thing, it's just something that's spontaneous and that you can do with other people at the same time. And just like a little bit of excitement in a time that feels really drained of spontaneity and communal experiences.
Are there other obscure sports that are getting more attention as bigger sports like basketball and baseball shut down?
Yeah, so table tennis was big, but also Belarusian soccer. They'd call it the football league in Belarus. Basketball in Taipei, in Taiwan. Oh, darts. Darts is big. So there's like a bunch of like these weird sports that hadn't gotten much play before, but have taken center stage over the last 4 or 5 weeks. And these companies don't release, most of them didn't give me numbers. One company did, the one that runs the Rivers Casino in Pittsburgh and the Rivers Casino in Philly, said table tennis was like 75% of their total sports betting bets over the last month. But most just said table tennis is the big one, and there's a couple more.
So actually, there is a serious side to this, though, and it's the fact that Pennsylvania gets a fair bit of tax revenue from online sports betting. So what kind of losses is the state seeing or anticipating?
Yeah, you're right. Pennsylvania has the highest tax revenue from commercial non-tribal gambling of any state in the country, including Nevada, which I thought was kind of surprising because taxes are higher here and it's a big state. But it's Pennsylvania and New York. You know, Pennsylvania got $1.4 billion, I believe, in 2018 from commercial gambling. So the shutdown of casinos and the shutdown of the industry is really, really bad. And table tennis may be popular with the folks who want to keep betting, but it is a drop in the bucket compared to real sports. You know, sports betting's online handle, so just the money that was being bet online, fell by 60% from February to March. Table tennis isn't making up for the loss of these other sports. And also, online sports betting is growing. It's this new industry that is becoming increasingly popular, but it doesn't even compare to the money that's made and the tax revenue that's collected from casinos, in-person casinos. I mean, that's where the real money is. So I don't think it's quite clear yet, you know, how bad of an economic picture it'll be for the state for the loss of these revenues. I think state lawmakers, people who do policy around this are dealing with the fact that like all revenue is, so much revenue is lost. You know, it's not just casinos, it's everything. But this is going to be really painful, especially if the casinos can't open up for a while.
Yeah, I would imagine it's going to be quite a while before people are shoulder to shoulder around the roulette wheel again.
Yeah. And you know, it's worth pointing out that Pennsylvania is one of only a few states that has moved slots and poker and other games that you think about playing in person online. So you can play those games. And revenue for online gaming, so not sports betting, but those sorts of games, went way up in the last report, which I think covered March. But it's a glimmer of hope in a terrible situation, but it's not going to replace what's been lost.
Miles, thanks so much for your reporting this week.
Thanks for having me, and thanks for listening.
That's Pittsburgh Explainer for this week. Our show is produced by Katie Blackley. Larkin Page Jacobs is our managing editor. You can find all of our news coverage at our website, WESA.FM, and of course on the air at 90.5 FM. I'm your host, Liz Reed. Thanks for listening. Let's talk next week.